It's the 100th episode of the Rise and Shout podcast. And in this supersized and awesome 100th episode of the podcast, we welcome back for a record-breaking 13th time the voice of the Cougars on KSL, Greg Rebel. We chat with him first about the really bad week for BYU Hoops and Dave Rose and what that means going forward. And we also talk with him about legendary BYU sports broadcaster Jay Monson, who passed away this past Sunday. I'm then joined by my brother Matt to celebrate our 100th episode. We answer a lot of tweetback questions. We talk a little bit about Robert and I and what his revamped offense might look like. We also tackle the tough week of BYU hoops. And of course, we answer a lot of tweetback questions and do a lot of the year 2000 pop culture references. This is the Rise and Shout podcast. You can listen to us and read us at vanquishthefoe.com. You can, of course, download us on iTunes. You can tweet at us at BYU_RiseShout. And you're going to listen to that awesome, supersized, wonderful-sized 100th episode right now. Welcoming back to the Rise and Shout podcast for a record-breaking, well, record-breaking because you, Greg, has set the record and then reset it each time he comes on. Record-breaking 14th time on our 100th episode. It's Greg Rebel of KSL. Greg, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I want to make sure I just stay out in front of that. If I'm ever seriously threatened, let me know, and we'll do a couple quick appearances to kind of, you know, space that lead out again.
Absolutely. So let's start off, Greg. And by the way, I'm not really good at math, but if you've been on 14 times and we have 100, I believe that means you've been on 14% of the time. So
that's pretty good. Yeah, that's a pretty good rate. It's still below the Mendoza line, but I think it's still pretty respectable. Yeah.
So let's start out with hoops. That might be the last jovial interchange between us for the next little bit. Let's start out with hoops. It's been a pretty tough week. I think a lot of fans, the first loss, you could kind of say, well, you know, San Diego's a decent team and it's just one of those games, and you're always going to lose one of those games during the season. We saw, you know, Indiana fall to Illinois. I mean, it just happens. But then the San Francisco game comes, and it's not just a loss, but it's a kind of a drubbing there in the second half. Yes, they were red hot, but most of the shots were wide open. What's the state of the team at this point? Is this a team in disarray or dysfunction, or is this just kind of one of those things where they just hit a really rough patch a couple of games in a row?
Well, in BYU's case, their resume was such that they really could not afford the kinds of games they had in either game last week, because they're not Indiana losing to Illinois. They are a team without a marquee win, a decent profile in terms of having no bad losses before last week, but a team without a marquee win. So if you're that team, knowing you're still going to have chances to play St. Mary's and Gonzaga multiple times, ideally between now and Selection Sunday, you just have to stay away from the bad loss. And the San Diego game was just that. And so for me, you know, the bubble, if you will, kind of burst against San Diego. What happened against San Francisco was unfortunate and disappointing and startling and all those things, but the damage had been done two nights before. I don't think a lot changed with the loss to San Diego. It kind of compounded the misery, if you will. But I think once you lose to San Diego, you've got that loss that those that want to keep you out of the field can use to keep you out of the field. Now, you do play Gonzaga and St. Mary's multiple times, and if you were to get hot against those teams and win two or three games, you'd give the committee pause again on Selection Sunday. But I think Dave Rose believes, and I think the players are of the mindset now, that, you know, they've got to go win that tournament in Las Vegas. I think the San Diego loss kind of set those particular wheels in motion. The San Diego loss was disappointing because of how well BYU started the game on the road. What was unusual was how well San Diego State or San Diego's bigs played in hanging with BYU. The Toreros are a guard-oriented team, and I think the first 16 or 18 points from USD were all scored from bigs. And BYU should have, at least in my belief, should have been able to do a better job with San Diego's bigs than they did. Once they got off, it gave that team a great deal of confidence, and ultimately, you know, once it became a game, BYU never really got back on top of that one. I was much more upset after the San Diego game than the San Francisco game, because the San Francisco game was just an occurrence the like of which I've never seen before. You can say the shots were open, but I defy you to put, you know, an array of players at the three-point line without anybody guarding them and have them go, you know, 13 of 14, which is how the team ended the game. It was as if somebody snapped their fingers and all of a sudden everything San Francisco shot went in the net. I mean, they were shooting 40% for the first 30 minutes or so, and they shot 75% for the last 10. I'm being general, but that was basically what happened. You wish BYU had the kind of guys who could answer shot for shot, but other than Craig Cusick, who made a couple of unfortunately kind of inconsequential threes late in the game, there was nobody BYU could turn to that night to answer. And you could really start and stop with the big three. It was a night on which the role players actually played quite well, but there you had Hawes, Davies, and Carlino going 12 for 40. If any of them had an average night, BYU likely wins the game. They all three had bad nights at the same time. And again, there were a handful of unusual occurrences, and it was a perfect storm against BYU on Saturday night.
Yeah. So one of the players that struggled, you mentioned, was Hawes. I think it's just accepted as kind of common that coming back off a mission, regardless of what sport you come back to play, that you have kind of that, you hit a wall at some point. I had a friend who was in track, and she came back off her mission after 18 months off and struggled a couple months after getting back to hit some of her times. And it's just one of those things we kind of accept. Is that what's happening with Hawes? Is this just a bad streak? I mean, was he just so good at the beginning of the year? We just maybe set the bar of expectation a little too high for him?
No, because I don't think he's hit the wall. He was averaging 21 points a game non-conference. He was averaging 21 points a game in conference. He scored 27 and 16 in the two games last week. So for the week, his average was actually better than his current average. So to me, Tyler Hawes hasn't hit the wall at all. He had a bad shooting night. He's been incredibly consistent. If you look before the USF game, his point total had increased in five successive games. His point totals were going up and up and up, and he capped at 27 against San Diego, came back down to 16 versus USF. But this is a guy that, if anything, is simply showing the effects of 26 games of physical battering. I mean, he runs and takes body checks for 40 minutes. This is not a guy that comes up the floor with the ball in his hands looking for his shot. This is a guy that they call plays for. This is a guy that has to run to get open. This is a guy that has to take punishment to get his shot. And he's done it incredibly well. Again, he's 11th in the country in scoring. And for a return missionary to be as proficient as he is, says all you need to know about who he is. He's not a regular guy. He's not an average, everyday return missionary. He is in as good a shape as any player who has either played or not played for two consecutive years coming into this season. He won the mile run before the season. You know, they run every player and time them on their mile run, and he won the thing. And he's months removed from the Philippines, and he won the mile run against guys that have been playing straight through while he's been gone. So I just don't buy. Yeah, I don't buy the mission wall with Tyler. He's certainly feeling the effects of the season. But it's because of the kind of player he is and how much punishment he takes. He's focused in on by every opponent, every scouting report, get to Tyler Hawes and you beat BYU. And that's what he has to take into every game. And the refs can't call everything, or they'd be calling everything all night long. And so there's a balance there. And so they know they can't call every bump he takes on every cut he makes, and so they don't. And by the end of the game, he's feeling it. But I think, again, for the season, I haven't seen a major drop off. He's had some bad shooting nights, but doesn't every player? But for the year, I have no complaints about this guy, and I don't think he's had it. I don't think he's finished for the year. I don't think anything like that. I think he just had a bad shooting night against San Francisco when they could have used him to have a better night. But his free throws were back on. He was 8 for 8 after having some recent struggles from the stripe. And I think that's something I look to as well, to see where his head's at and how his body's feeling. And so, whatever struggles BYU has had, I can't really pin any of them on Tyler Hawes right now.
No, I think you're right. I think it's he's had some great games even recently, but I think it's just that common thing. We all just say it when somebody has a bad game and it's the year after their mission. I think it's just one of those narratives you play. One of the other narratives that people like to play is after a game like that, you saw this on Twitter a little bit afterwards, but among some of the fans was just, well, does this team have the heart? Does the team have the chemistry and those kind of things? Are there legitimate concerns from your perspective there, especially on chemistry? There was Coach Rose had some comments in December and January that some fans interpreted as maybe some chemistry issues. I interpreted it more as he was just talking about on the floor chemistry, not necessarily off the floor type of stuff. Are those legitimate narratives to say that there could be some chemistry issues or some character issues, or is that just one of those things where that gets pointed out when you lose, but when you win, everyone kind of forgets and doesn't think much about that?
Well, I just haven't heard a lot discussed about chemistry or character, whatever you talked about in terms of that. I think that tonight on the coach's show, Dave Rose said that there were a few too many guys, maybe in this last week, freelancing a bit defensively, trying to do too many things on their own, not understanding how important what they were doing was to the success of their teammates. You could point to some tactical, resetting this week, if you will, to make sure everyone knows their assignments. But it's a group with great chemistry. And beyond the fact that you've got a few players who wish they were playing more, and they're probably not happy about the way their seasons have gone. And I'm talking about Raul Delgado and Augie Ambrosino and Corey Calvert primarily. Beyond those guys who wish to have played more and haven't, I don't think you can say that there are any issues, within the team that way. Those are players who are naturally, would be naturally disappointed that they haven't had the seasons they expected to have this year. But beyond that, I can't point to bigger issues regarding leadership or chemistry. Certainly not character. This is a good bunch of guys who really do get along quite well, and so that's not what I see. But I think what Dave Rose sees is, like I said a moment ago, a week in which maybe a few too many guys lost sight of particular team concepts as they relate to the defensive side of the floor. And that's what they'll try and address this week. It was a really bad week, but like Dave Rose said again tonight, things can turn very quickly. They felt very good going into last week, and things turned pretty quickly. And they can feel good about themselves again if they play right and get right. I think what you do, a justifiable flaw on this year's team is that with the scholarships they had available after last season, they brought in players who have not panned out, have not had the impact Dave Rose thought they would have. When you add to that the fact that he brought into the season two players on scholarship who had to quit the sport, that also set BYU back in terms of depth. This is not the depth that BYU's or that Dave Rose thought he would have this season. That's just a fact. He's not as deep a team as he thought he'd have. In fact, in a lot of ways, Adam, this is kind of last year's team. This is the same team they had with Tyler Hawes basically occupying the Noah Hartsock role and no one really occupying the Charles Abubo role. So they could actually be kind of a net loss from last year to this point. And you never want to see that. I mean, you go through a year like last year where you do some great things, probably fall short in a way, and you realize you have depth limitations when Noah Hartsock gets hurt, and you do everything you can to improve your situation for next year. Well, you can't say that it has. In fact, you could say they may have taken a step back in depth. As good as Tyler Hawes has been, And as good as Matt Carlino and Brandon Davies have been, there have been too many nights where the big three don't have enough help. And then on a night when they do get some help, a bad night from those guys can actually scuttle the team too. So, you know, that's the one thing I think you wish would have been better is they had a better handle on personnel when the season began. The Rogers-Collinsworth thing certainly hurts. And they brought in guys in Augie, Raul, and Corey Calvert who are all known as what? Three-point shooters, guys who can stretch defense. And none of them had that role this season. And so, to that extent, they've had to ride Brandon and Tyler a lot harder than they thought they would have to. And that's been a big factor.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And hopefully this is the week where they turn it around because I think they are capable of a run. I know a lot of fans, after seeing a couple of these losses, don't think so, and I understand feeling that way. But I think they can.
Yeah, I think when you've got a trio with as much talent as just those three guys, when they are on at the same time, BYU would be very tough to beat by any team. And that's still a team they have right now. I mean, generally speaking, Haas and Carlino and Davies are healthy and ready to go on a run. And when they're on together, yeah, they're really tough to beat. And then it's not just this weekend. Portland at home doesn't concern me a great deal. But it starts a three-game stretch that goes Saturday, Tuesday, Thursday with a road trip between the Tuesday and Thursday game and no practice on the Sunday. So what you've got is Portland, Utah State, St. Mary's, you know, in a six-day stretch if you want to include the game days themselves, with travel involved and lack of practice on one of the days. And so this will be very telling. Can BYU get out of this next three-game stretch at 2-1 or 3-0? Certainly 2-1 the minimum expectation. 3-0, and now you're at 21 wins, and now you're thinking, hey, are we back on the bubble yet? And then you get a week to find out when Gonzaga comes to town. So let's imagine for a moment that BYU were to win its next four games, five with LMU finishing out the conference season. Well, now you're looking at a 23-8 team going to Vegas with a chance to get to 24 or 25 wins. Can they do enough to get themselves back into at-large consideration? The percentages say no, but the possibilities exist. And so you never want to shut the door, even though realistically, I think Dave and his guys think that they've got to win the tournament. You never want to shut the door, but ideally you get a win or two against these tougher teams down the stretch just to show that you're capable, just to give the players belief that when they go to Vegas, they actually could go on a run. And wouldn't it be interesting, you know, after all these years of when BYU had these, these 30-win type seasons where they go to Vegas with the target on their back, they go to Vegas this time with no one expecting much from them, and who's to say that this isn't the way they finally get that tournament win, the conference tournament title win that has escaped them since 2001. It's been a long, long time since BYU won a conference tournament title, and it'd be interesting if it happened this way. Certainly the odds wouldn't be in their favor, but, you know, that's a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's shift gears entirely here. On Sunday passed away a member of the BYU Sports Hall of Fame, Jay Monson, and I know he was a colleague of yours, and you wrote a very nice piece about him in Cougar Tracks on Sunday. I just wanted to talk with you about one of the things that not just you, but several other people that have either worked in the field around BYU tweeted or posted, almost all of them the exact same thing, which was the thing I found so remarkable, was I came to him and I was interested in coming into this field, and he helped me get into it and helped me do that. I know you had recounted that experience, so I'd love for you to talk to us about what Jay Monson meant to you personally and what you thought he thinks he means to BYU sports.
Well, I think you'd always want to be the person, you know, about whom somebody could say, you know, he helped me. And I'm able to say that about Jay, and I hope that, you know, somewhere down the line others can say that about me, because I've had many people come to me with the same kind of requests that I had for Jay, which was, you know, can I do something for you? Can I help you and at the same time give me a better understanding of the profession and the industry, and a chance to kind of get a foot in the door. And he was that kind of person for me, and I hope to be that kind of person for others, over the years. Because when you're a young, aspiring broadcaster, you you know, you watch and listen to people that you want to be like, and you just wonder how it is you can get on that path. There's no real manual for that. There's many different ways to get on the path, but for me, you know, getting on the path was walking into the KBYU TV newsroom as a 17-year-old and saying, I want to be a sportscaster, put me to work. And they said, okay, can you go do a story on a BYU team no one knows about? And I said, okay. And I went and I found the club fencing team, the BYU club fencing team that they had back in the day. And they assigned me a photographer, a videographer, and it was Jay's son, Dave. And I knew enough already about BYU to know the Monson name, and now I was all of a sudden working with Jay's son, which was to me, you know, kind of enough pressure in and of itself. Dave was wonderful and reminded me of just how that was kind of a family trait in terms of kindness and generosity. And so working with Dave, literally in my first or second week at BYU as a 17-year-old freshman, you know, got me exposed to that branch of the Monson family tree. And then over time, I would approach Jay later and ask to be involved, and he let me be involved. As I wrote in the story, he let me, you know, file radio reports for different stations for both the football and basketball games. And it was something that he had students do on a rotating basis, of course, year by year. But I got to be that guy for a season or two, and that really helped me out. At the same time, I was trying to do everything else in my career in terms of getting internships and working hard at KBYU. But he was certainly a big part of my upbringing in the industry and doing it here locally. And then, you know, he was always someone that would give me, you know, supportive comments and positive feedback. And then lately, you know, later when he was retired, I was able to call on him to actually do games on occasions where I'd have a football conflict, and he would kindly do that as well. So just a really special person in my life, and you know, relative to BYU broadcasting, I mean most of Cougar Nation out there grew up with Paul James on the radio and Jay Monson on TV. You know, there were other people involved, but primarily, you know, those two guys kind of occupied the joint mantle of voice of the Cougars. And so For so many BYU fans, I'd say maybe a majority of BYU fans still out there, you know, PJ and Jay were their guys. You know, that was BYU sports for them. And, you know, you couldn't ask for two better guys to kind of, you know, carry you along as a fan following BYU. So many of their calls, radio or TV, are fixed as you know, definable memories for them growing up. And so, you know, what a great legacy for Jay to have left and for PJ to have left too. And now that Jay has passed, I think people, you know, realize, that he was much, you know, very much a part of their fandom and, very, very, you know, greatly missed.
What you described, Greg, is exactly what I grew up with. I mean, we lived in Utah till I was 11. We used to go to the games. We'd listen to Paul James on the way home, good or bad or whatever had happened in the game. We'd listen to him on the post-game show on the way back, and then we would, if we were watching on TV, it was very often Jay calling the game for BYU football. And like you said, that's just what I grew up with. Those were the two voices that any time I heard their voices, I could automatically know who they were, and a lot of times within a few seconds know what game it was that they were pulling from to do that. So like you said, it's
you know, not to interrupt, I'm sorry, but something I didn't, I mean, what Jay did was, you know, was turn, you know, KBYU TV into a sports entity, you know, and later with the, you know, with the Blue and White Network, which was a precursor to, of course, BYU TV Sports Now. You know, Jay Monson was a forerunner. You know, he was in the middle of establishing, you know, KBYU, BYU TV as a destination for BYU fans. And so, and you know, beyond that, he had a sports information role, you know, as the electronic media relations director that brought him into close contact with sports media in the market for decades. And we, you know, in the traditional quote unquote sports media, are grateful to Jay for how helpful and supportive he was in that job. He wasn't just a play by play voice.
He was also an administrator there at BYU, and a very good one. And again, helped people like myself get their feet wet and start careers. And so he'll be missed in so many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Greg, thank you so much for sharing those personal thoughts on Jay, and also your insights and thoughts on the basketball team as well. We appreciate it. I miscounted; it's actually 13 times.
But still leading.
Still leading. You're now three ahead of Jay. You're really the two of you who are pretty much the only ones. I mean, Dick is up there as well, at like six, and Brandon Gurney at five. So they're kind of, you know, in your you two are the Gonzaga and St. Mary's of this race. I'll put it that way.
Well, it's a spirited competition, but there's no animosity. I don't hold it against Jay that he's as close to me as he is. But again, if he ever, you know, is within an appearance or so of me, let's knock a couple quick ones out and just kind of keep that cushion. All right.
We can do that. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Greg, and we'll definitely have you on again, and keep you ahead of Jay.
Adam, it's always my pleasure, and whenever you call, I'll be here. And again, this is an exciting time still. Maybe a little less so with BYU kind of bouncing off the bubble for the time being, but still an exciting time, rife with possibilities. And I still believe this team has within it, the capacity and the ability to make a run here and do some fun things down the stretch. And so I'll be excited along with you and all the BYU fans to see what they can do this weekend and beyond. And, never say never. So it should be a fun stretch run.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thanks.
So, Matt, I had promised big guess. Big guess.
And were you talking about, like, size?
No, not necessarily. But all I got was you. sorry, everybody. All I could muster up. No, we had Greg on already on the podcast, and he's an awesome guest. But I was hoping to actually squeeze you out entirely, so there'd be like 5 minutes at the end where it's just you and I going, "Oh, those were awesome." But we're working on some big guests. I can't guarantee anything, but unfortunately, the stars did not align for episode 100.
That's fine, because that's the way it is.
That is the way it is. So, anyway, sorry to disappoint everybody, but let's disappoint some other people by talking about baseball.
By continuing to talk.
Let's talk about baseball first. Zach Bloxham, who is one of our fellow writers at VanquishTheFoe.com, actually, he's an editor there. He's a big shot. He loves baseball and loves when we talk about baseball on the podcast.
He suggested that we have just a pure baseball podcast that run separately from this.
And we may do that at some point, based on his recommendation.
Completely based off of his recommendation.
Completely. But his favorite team are the Cleveland Indians. And I've got two beefs right now, Matt, with you and America and the world.
Wow, this sounds pretty serious.
So, you come into this season, you are a Nats fan.
Yes, I am.
For the baseball uninitiated, that's the Washington Nationals, formerly the Montreal Expos.
I was not an Expos fan, but I've been a Nats fan since 2005.
Look at you trying to qualify it.
No, I'm just trying to be clear, all right?
Just trying to be clear.
I didn't used to have to do that. In the past, I would say I'm a Nats fan, and you'd get, oh, they have fans?
Yes, and now the bandwagon has gotten a little more crowded.
Listen, when I walk into the mall in West Lafayette, Indiana, and I see a guy my age wearing a Nats hat that I don't know, like...
You know that your team has come.
Something's going on.
Hey, when we grew up as Red Sox fans, though you were never a big fan of the Red Sox, when we grew up as Red Sox fans, I would wear my Red Sox hat at high school and get mocked.
They were bad.
We were 20 miles south of Boston. Nobody wanted to wear the hat. Anyway.
We used to get great seats at games.
So here's the thing. The Nats are going to be, barring injury or something strange, one of the best teams in baseball. Right?
Yep.
This year, your team comes in with all this expectations. The Red Sox come in with, well, not much. Let's turn to the tweet back, Matt. I used to like him.
That's UR classless. That's at UR underscore classless. But then he asked us in the TweetBag question, please talk about how bad the Red Sox are. NPS, Kurt Schilling colored his sock with magic marker and Poppy used roids. Two out of those three things are probably true. The Red Sox are going to be probably not very good.
No, they're not going to be good. It's a bad situation in Boston right now.
Yes. David Ortiz may have used steroids.
Listen, I'm just operating under the assumption that every Major League Baseball player has.
I mean, it's high. Kurt Schilling did not color his sock with magic marker. It was a combination of food coloring and sand.
If it was coloring, I think he broke open a Sharpie and let it drip into the sock.
So anyway, the Red Sox are not going to be great. The Indians, on the other hand, have signed Nick Swisher and now Michael Bourne.
Not to be confused with Jason Bourne.
No, that would have been a much better signing. The Indians might be better than the Red Sox this year.
Well, if the Indians, they also need to re-sign that that one pitcher, Wild Thing. Then they're going to be really good.
They would be really good. They would. Is he in prison again?
I don't know.
The craziest part is that's Charlie Sheen that played.
But I'm under the impression that he is the reason that the Indians are Zach Bloxham's favorite baseball team.
I think it could be.
I don't know if that's true or not, but that's kind of what I gathered off of Twitter the other day.
Curtis Larson, that's at KW Larson on Twitter, asked us, A's or Indians, which team will win the World Series? Well, they both can't be in the World Series at the same time. But the A's actually, they made the playoffs last year.
Is this the A's with Brad Pitt in the front office?
of course, he's still there. He hasn't been fired yet.
Then they always have a chance.
So, well, You Are Classless asks us a serious question.
Okay.
He said any baseball talk is acceptable. He asked about favorite baseball movie. Matt, do you have a favorite baseball movie?
Field of Dreams.
Boy, that was fast.
Oh, absolutely Field of Dreams. It's also my favorite baseball book, but the book, obviously, as you know, is Shoeless Joe.
Oh, the book is fantastic. The book is fantastic. I love the movie, but the book is really good.
Yeah, the movie is more accurate, but the book... No, I'm sorry. I'm on one tonight. But the... they're both really good. That movie is very good. I also really like the version of...
I love Darth Vader in it. Darth Vader's really good in that movie.
The version of Eight Men Out that had... John Cusack and those guys in it.
The version of it? What do you mean?
I think there's an older version of that movie.
Really?
I think so. I'll Google it and see, but I thought I had seen once an older version of that movie, or like a real cheap-made version on Netflix or something.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Interesting. Anyway.
What about you? Favorite baseball movie?
Favorite baseball movie? I mean, some people... Field of Dreams is it for me, but I'll tell you what's really close, and this is one where people hate it or love it. Seemingly, is the Natural.
The Natural's a good movie. I like The Natural.
It has one major flaw, and that is Robert Redford was too old to be the main character. Because him as the young guy who's like 20 trying to make it in the majors, they did the makeup and everything, but it just looks like some old dude playing a 20-year-old. But other than that, I love that movie, and I think he and Wilford Brimley are actually the same age, and Wilford Brimley was playing the old grizzled manager, or they're close to the same age or something. But I really like that. But Field of Dreams, to me, that's, you know, that James Earl Jones speech about baseball, if that doesn't still send chills up your spine, I don't think you have a spine.
No, you're not alive.
You're not alive. You're not alive. So your Nats are going to be good. My Red Sox are not likely to be very good. The Indians could be good. And my World Series prediction here early, early in spring training is Nationals and Rangers. So there you go.
Wow,
would you like to make a World Series prediction?
I would like to not make a World Series prediction out of silly baseball superstition.
Don't want to jinx your team. Don't want to jinx your team. Okay, Matt, so let's keep going on this tweet bag theme, because we had some excellent tweet bag questions. One I'm going to pull out. We had several tweet bag questions from our two of our most frequent tweet baggers. That's Justin Sweeney, at Justin D. Sweeney, and the Irish Mexican, which is at Bullishism. Let's see. So Justin says, can anyone besides a select few family members and him say they have listened to every single episode? Justin, you are overestimating the usage of this podcast by our family members. I would be shocked.
My wife finally listened to one a couple weeks ago.
I would be shocked if there's a single person besides you, Justin, that has listened to all 100 episodes. And I'm probably wrong, right? There's probably somebody.
I'm guessing that there is somebody else out there.
I've listened to all 100.
This is awkward. But I've not listened to all 100.
No, you have not.
I have a hard enough time listening to you while we're recording the podcast, much less listening to you later. But,
So he asks, Justin asks a question related to BYU sports. And this will be our first talking of BYU sports.
Oh, look, and we're only like 15 minutes in.
Really? 15 minutes? No, we're like 10 minutes in. You exaggerate. He quotes the Robert and I press conference, and this was on signing day. And you can look at it at VanquishTheFoe.com, which they've got all 19 minutes of it from BYU TV's YouTube feed. He asks, an ICE motto, go fast and go hard. His solution is simplify the offense. Sound familiar? Can it be different the second time around? Matt, can it be different the second time around?
It absolutely can be different the second time around. I think – people learn and they grow. I think it sounds to me, he was very candid in this press conference. He talked about the whole situation when he left. He talked about things that he learned at Arizona, not just, dealing with the players and the systems, but also with some of the stuff that happened with the coaching staff while he was there. I think that we're looking at a different Anai than we saw in the past. The real question for me is, can he execute it the way that he's describing it? And that's really what this comes down to. I have no doubt that he's going to try and do things differently, that he's going to try and do something new. We can talk a little bit about some of the stuff specifically I like about what he said in a minute, but I think it absolutely can be different the second time around. That's all about, the question is really, do you think Anai's got like a growth arc? And I think that he does.
Well, here's the thing. It doesn't have to be that different. We've talked about this before. I know you are a Robert and I hater. But his most, except for his last season, which was bad, the rest of his seasons, there were very good offenses. Granted, he had some good quarterbacks during his tenure in Beck and Hall. So, there were some really good quarterbacks that played. And these last few years, we haven't had quarterback play that good. So, but regardless, there's that. What he said, though, specifically about, he said something else as well, and I don't know if it was in that press conference or something, a different interview later on, where he said something about 8 yards a play, 90 plays a game, 40-plus points.
Yeah.
Last year we were hearing things like, we'd like to average 25 points a game. What? You'd like to be one of the worst third offenses in the country? That's the goal?
Hey, well, we met that goal. We were that group.
It was a strange, when Dolan talked about his goals for the offense, it was just weird. It was like, that's the goal? That's what we want to do? I don't know.
I think a lot of that was about managing expectations. I think they knew they were in trouble.
Well, shoot for the skies, man. Manage what expectations? They were terrible. Aim higher. It didn't help. At least, maybe internally it did. I can't speak to that. But it certainly didn't help the fans. Nobody was like, oh, well, the goal was 25 points a game. We're okay scoring 6 points against Boise. It'll average out by the end.
Oh, I agree.
So I was very pleased that, as they say, some of this is going to really depend on how it's executed, right? You can shoot higher, But will you actually get there?
Yes, you know what I mean? I do. I know what you mean.
So I just need to know if he can actually execute all this.
You know, I'll tell you what. If he can't, then he's going to be showing me the meaning of being lonely.
Yes, yes.
People are going to be pretty upset. Right now, fans are willing to welcome him back with arms wide open.
Dang, never! I had that in my queue. It was ready to go, you scumbag.
But the question we all, what we really want to see here is, you know, we saw one version of Anai. He's now described what would be another version of Anai, and so really what we need is for the real Slim Shady to please stand up.
You could have used that one better. I think you wasted that one. Yeah, I agree with you.
You wasted that one.
Oh, I didn't actually use it. That was a really weak comeback, too. Man, this is a rough, like, 40 seconds for you. I'm sorry about that. I'm not editing it out, though. This is 0% chance of an edit coming there. So Matt, I agree with everything you're saying. I think there is a very good chance that this offense is very different than the one he ran when he was the offensive coordinator the first time. So I think there's a very good chance of that.
Hopefully he's found the kryptonite for opposing defenses.
Hopefully he has. Hopefully he has. And he's going to need to, because as we've discussed several times in this podcast, that 2013 schedule is big. So let's stick to signing day for a second here, Matt. We had a tweet bag question from the Irish Mexican on that. He asked, both Vandy and Kentucky had better football recruiting rankings than BYU. Even on paper, shouldn't we be doing better than them? I'll start with this one. I'll let you go last, go first on the last one. I don't care about rankings of prospects. There's too many prospects. As a stats guy, if you take the variability on prospects and then you rank them, a ranking doesn't mean jack squat. If you're not in the top like 15 or so, what that basically means is either your recruiting class wasn't very good or they really don't have any idea who the people are. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't care about that stuff. Yes, it looked like an off year according to those rankings. But if you have three or four studs come out of this, then no one will care. And if you don't, it didn't matter what the ranking was. You look at the 2010 class, which has been brought up several times since this got posted. Yeah, the 2010 class that was supposed to be all that. Yeah, they've been awesome, you know. Made a really good quarterback to transfer to Kansas. I don't care about any of the rankings. These people don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, as Janet Jackson says, it doesn't really matter. You know, I don't know these people that do the rankings. I don't know how many of these games they get out to.
They can't get how many.
But I'll tell you what, the games that they get out to are in places where the big time players have come from in the past, which is why the SEC does really well in these things. I mean, granted, they're recruiting really high talent, but Vanderbilt, they're recruiting players from the same schools as some of the other teams in their conference, and these are places that have produced big time players in the past, and so sure. Those are areas that it's a lot easier for some of these guys that do this recruiting stuff to get information. But where BYU and Bronco Mendenhall has made this clear, that's not what they're after. They're trying to find people who will fit inside of the system. And in this, at BYU, that isn't just about the play calling and the formations. It's also about the institution. And their job is to find the best players they can, or players that have the most potential that they can find that will also work at BYU. And that is the context they have to recruit in. Yeah. That's just the reality of it. And BYU is never going to land consistently these big time bunch of stars types of recruits. It just isn't going to happen. And frankly, you put us on the field against Vanderbilt. Oh, that last year is an exception to that. But Because I really don't know if we would have beat Vanderbilt.
Out of the
last
past
year.
40 years, you put us on the field against Vanderbilt, and we would destroy them. 38 of those games.
We would destroy them.
I mean, come on.
You know, the Anaya offense is in his prime. You know, anyway, it. So I'm not really worked up about that. You don't really know about any of this until these guys get on the field.
Yeah, it's just I don't care about it. I really don't. There are thousands upon thousands of high school games every year. There are players that get a lot of hype, and mainly they get hype because of who they get recruited by. And then the recruiting services give them 4 or 5 stars because so-and-so started recruiting them. You know what I mean?
Right. There's been instances where guys lose stars when BYU starts to recruit them.
Doesn't matter to me. Doesn't matter to me. I just, it's not something I lose any sleep over at all. Not anything I lose sleep over. He asked another question unrelated to all of this, Matt, is speaking of rivals, and he's speaking of Utah, what are our thoughts on Erickson as the co-offensive coordinator at Utah?
It's great.
It's fantastic. Let's sow some dysfunction.
I couldn't be happier.
At what over under year that recruiting violations get attached to the University of Utah, or somebody shows up on Twitter with the coach drunk with a co-ed?
Is he in an office now? Will he be recruiting for the team for this fall?
Hey, none of those allegations were proven. Okay. Erickson's, I mean, he's actually hasn't gotten in trouble in quite a while, but he's got a checkered past, and quite frankly, doesn't this smell like desperation?
I also don't know that he's been, really honestly, when was his heyday? When did his career peak?
15 years ago?
Okay, when he was where?
When he got hired to go to the pros, right? He was a big...
Where had he been right before that? Oregon?
Oregon State, I think. Wasn't he Oregon State?
So, and then he goes to... He gets picked up in the pros. It's a big deal. Since then, like, really? This sounds like we're going to try and get somebody with a big name on our staff. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'd like to know what Aaron Roderick thinks about it.
Oh, it wasn't Oregon State. It was Washington State. We're both idiots. No, it was Oregon State. He went back to Oregon State. He's been so many places, it's hard to keep track, including Idaho twice, though the second trip was very, very brief. But he was a disaster in Seattle, then went to San Francisco. He got 2 head coaching stops. Not good in either. Just a strange career, actually. If you look at his Wikipedia page, it is really weird. It is 4 seasons at Idaho, 1 at Wyoming, 2 at Washington State, in which the first year he was 3-7-1, then to Miami, and then Miami was the launching place into the pros. Where he was very good at Miami, had a 63-9 record at Miami. But since then, 31-17 at Oregon State when he was the head coach, 1 season at Idaho, and then went to Arizona State and had 1 team finish above 500 while he was there. So, I'm not like shaking in my boots, I'll put it that way.
No, but I think their coaching staff situation is going to be interesting.
Kind of a mess.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people have thought Anai coming back was weird, but I think theirs at this time is weirder. So, anywho, let's talk hoops, Matt, because what will bring down the 100th episode of this podcast faster than talking about one of the worst weeks in BYU basketball history?
This is where I want to be, talking about BYU hoops.
This is where you want to be. So, Matt, just had, or at least for the viewers, gosh, 100 episodes in, I still think people are
still
watching
doing
us.
That. They can't see you.
And if they are, then that's creepy.
And probably illegal.
Well, it depends on the state. So, to the listeners, they'll have just heard Greg talk about how he thought that the worst loss was the San Diego one because it was first and it kind of signaled, man, some miraculous things have to happen to get into the NCAA tournament. To me, it was San Francisco. And I know they shot lights out in the second half, and I get that. It's just to lose by that much on your home floor after leading by 15, to me that's a crushing, crushing blow to a team that's not that good. San Diego's at least decent. San Francisco is not a, you know, a higher quality team. That was rough to me, a very rough, rough week. So are we just terrible? Is that the answer? I mean, terrible is too strong. We just not very good. Not one of the top 60-ish teams in the country.
I don't think that we are. And the scary part for me with the San Francisco game is it really looked like just all the air has been let out. I feel like there was a moment there where the players realized what the reality of their situation is. And, you know, they don't even went out or anything. Like, they just kind of cruise through the end of this and go to the NIT and call it. And that's disheartening as a fan to see. And it's also sad for a team that has, well, I feel like a lot of potential and a little bit of untapped talent. You know, you talk about like some of the stuff with Carlino and some of the inconsistency, I think, for the team. And lack of depth obviously is an issue. But there's some good basketball players on this team. But they just can't get it together, and they're not quite good enough to be really good. And so it almost feels like they're kind of throwing it in.
Yeah, to me, there are two.
Is that unfair to say? I don't know.
I don't know. We actually talked with Greg about, you know, the character of the team and stuff, and neither he and I, you know, think that they're – here I am, you know, doing thought bubbles for Greg Rebel, but they're – neither of us are probably in that camp of, you know, they've given up or a character issue, but this is what it is to me. There are two really good players on this team, and that's it. I think there is a tendency to put Carlino as the big three. Greg uses that. A lot of people do. I don't think he's the big three. I don't. I don't think he's even close to Davies or Haas in value. And if you look at advanced stats, PER type of stuff, it would show that he's a step down from them. Now, a step above everybody else on the team, but we're grading on a curve. you know, the fourth most valuable player on the team is Sharp, who's had a very good season. And that's according to PER on sportsreference.com's version of it. And Sharp's had a good thing, but he should be like your sixth or seventh valuable player. That's where he should be.
Grading on a curve here is the entire problem, right? If you place these players, according to the stats you're talking about, on a curve, yeah, Carlino's in that group just because there's nobody else.
Yeah.
You know, if there's only two tiers of player on this team, he's in the upper tier. But if you're more realistic about breaking it down, he's not Haas or Davies. But everybody, we need him to be. The team needs him to be, and everybody wants him to be.
Yeah. And I'm not saying Carlino is terrible, right? So don't misinterpret this as a Carlino is terrible conversation, because I don't think he's terrible at all. I think he is a good player. I think he is a good team defensive player. And when he gets hot, he can be an exceptional offensive player. But for the most part, he's extremely inconsistent. You know, he's kind of crash and burn sometimes. And I don't know, he's frustrating to watch for me personally. I don't like his style of point guardness, you know. So, I don't know. This team, I'm going to keep watching. I mean, I love watching them for the most part. And, you know, I think their tournament chances are slim, but not as bad as what a lot of fans are saying, where they're saying it's impossible. I mean, it's not impossible. It's just not likely. You know? Just not likely.
You know, and when you look at the schedule, I mean, they have won a lot of games. They've got, you know, one or two losses on here that are a little bit more embarrassing. I can deal with the loss, you know, on the road to the Zags. I can almost deal with the loss at home to St. Mary's. You know, when you look back at some of these, I can deal with that. And this stuff earlier in the season, the Iowa State and all this, some of the stuff early, you know, they were still feeling things out. I mean, it's a decent team.
Yeah, the problem is they have no signature win.
No. And they've only got really one or two more chances at that.
Yeah.
Plus the tournament.
Yeah, they've got those, you know, in a couple of weeks that stretch two Thursdays in a row, St. Mary's and Gonzaga, and that's it. Those are your chances. If they were to win both of those games, which is not likely, but say they were, I think they're actually in the tournament as long as they don't lose in the first round of the West Coast Conference. If they split those or lose both, I think you've got to win the West Coast Conference tournament. Now, it's more likely that they win the tournament than they win the St. Mary's and Gonzaga games back-to-back. And let me explain before people say, well, they'd have to beat Gonzaga and St. Mary's to win the tournament. What I'm saying is, once you enter a tournament, there's a high degree of variability, and St. Mary's or Gonzaga could slip against somebody else, right? Their best shot at winning the whole tournament is if one of the other two of them loses before they have to play them, so they only have to beat one of them, you know?
And then they can lose to San Francisco in the finals.
You just punched me in the gut.
But that's the scary part of that, right?
You just punched me in the gut. You're talking about it's Las Vegas. It's like a second home spot for us.
Anything can happen in Vegas.
That's right. That's right. And luckily, it doesn't actually stay there. You get to take it with you, the conference championship.
that's good.
Yeah. So I'm not very hopeful, Matt, but I'm not burning the furniture and freaking out either. I mean,
no, I wouldn't recommend burning the furniture because if you set that fire, your insurance is not going to cover that.
No. Well, I was actually going to be at your house, but.
Well, I know my. Well, actually, if you start the fire, my insurance.
Yeah,
will
your
cover
insurance
it.
Will cover it. I mean, yeah, that's jail.
And I get new furniture. So actually, that's a win.
Actually, yes. Light it up, dude.
I mean, I've got decent furniture, but who doesn't want new furniture?
I do.
So anyway, I think there is still some room in here. Maybe we're being too optimistic. You know, I think looking backwards, I think you could look at the team and the current and the right now state of college basketball and say, yeah, like there is some chance that these guys make it. But realistically, if I look back over the body of work, I look what's left on the five games of the regular season schedule and then what I feel is likely going to happen at the tournament, I don't see this team making it into the NCAA tournament.
Well, I think the key is we just talked about Carlino. He's the key because I think Davies and Hawes will be who they are. You know, they weren't against San Francisco, but I think most nights they're going to be who they are. You know, Carlino is the one that will come in. And if he can play a high level for a couple weeks, or even that week of the tournament, that is what that could push them above. Because having three very good players, you know, giving very good efforts can put you through. And if he does that, he can throw the mic down and say, "How do you like me now?" You know?
Yeah, there you go.
So that's that. So, Matt, we have come to nearly the end of our podcast. And as usual, we're going to talk movies.
Movies!
So, it's the year 2000, you were on your mission.
Yep.
And you were in a faraway country where you probably didn't even hear about most of these movies till you got home, I'm guessing.
That is true, actually.
So...
And it would actually, some of these would have... I might have seen, like, posters or advertisements for some of this stuff later.
Sure.
But I didn't see any of these until I got home. And that's not just tongue-in-cheek some stuff, but, I mean, I would have no way of seeing any of these.
No, you couldn't have even broken the rules if you'd wanted to. So let's talk first last week from 1999. We had one of our siblings pointed out two misses we had. We did not talk about Fight Club or Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest, I have no response to that. I'm ashamed.
Wait, is Galaxy Quest the one with Tim Allen?
Yeah, yeah, it's the fake Star Trek movie. It's I actually really enjoy that movie.
Oh boy.
What are you? And then Fight Club. I've actually never seen Fight Club.
Well, you know the first rule about Fight Club.
No.
Never talk about Fight Club. Yeah, do you know exactly. The second rule about Fight Club?
Don't talk about Fight Club.
Don't talk about Fight Club.
Yeah, see, I've actually never seen Fight Club, so I know. I
was
wouldn't
just following
have
the rules when I didn't bring it up. I was just following the rules.
So let's talk about 2000. Three favorite movies, and then a underrated film from 2000. Go ahead, Matt. You go first.
Remember the Titans?
Oh, that's a good one.
I
watched that the other day on TV. That speech he gives at the field when he marches them all out in the middle of the night to run. Oh, my gosh. Goosebumps.
Oh, it's a great movie. And Denzel Washington is amazing in that movie.
Yeah, he's awesome.
That's a good movie. This is tough. I do remember I had one companion who had somebody
tell... Are you telling a mission story?
The whole story of Gladiator, and then he recounted the entire story to me while we were walking somewhere. I actually never saw the movie because the way he told the story was just so bad that I lost interest in it.
It's good.
Maybe I should give it a shot.
You probably should.
What else is good in here?
Wow, you're having a hard time with this. Do you want me to go first?
I have a hard time. Why don't you go first, okay. And then I'll grab one or two.
I'll go first. So number one to me is X-Men, mainly because I'm a comic book geek and we got to see an actual comic book film. The first one successful that wasn't Batman or Superman. And I read the X-Men comics, and I can't tell you how geeked out I was for that X-Men movie. I was also a big fan of the Gladiator movie. I really liked that. So that's my number two. And then my number three was kind of hard. There are a lot of movies I like there, but I'm going to pick Unbreakable, which I think is M. Night Shyamalan's favorite. I know we're grading on the curve with that. But Bruce Willis, also a superhero movie, but a very different kind of movie than X-Men or most superhero movies, and I actually really like that. And I realized that two out of the three of those movies are extremely depressing films. Maybe I was a very depressed person in 2000.
Well, I was gone. It was a difficult time for you.
Oh, I was pretty excited about that. Dropping you off at the MTC, one of the best days of my life.
Oh, you and a lot of other people.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Castaway.
Mm, also very good. Bring It On. You were going to say Bring It On as your number three.
Up there. It's close. I think my number three, I can't remember what I saw in here now. There's a lot of these that I haven't seen. Maybe Meet the Parents. There's a couple of pretty funny movies that came out in 2000.
Meet the Parents. Meet the Parents to me, though, is it's not like there are certain scenes that are rewatchable, but him, like, burning down, like, the thing that was hand-carved or whatever, it's just painful.
They didn't put so much lacquer on it.
Yeah.
And that's my wife's problem with that movie. She gets so fed up with, why does he keep doing these things? Why is he such an idiot?
Yeah. Yeah. But there are some pretty awesome scenes in that. You spray painted a cat? You're sick. I mean, it's got some quotable. I do have an underrated movie. For me, it's Frequency.
Frequency was good.
Was it like, you know, awesome, awesome movie, but it's good. It's like rewatchable. If it's on TV and I'm flipping around, and it showed us, I like Jim Caviezel in that movie, and it turns out that's the only character he can play in subsequent films. But
I heard you loved the movie Dude, Where's My Car?
That's
what I heard.
I have never seen Dude, Where's My Car, but for years after that, anytime someone was looking for their car, there was the obligatory Dude, Where's Your Car?
I'm glad I missed that.
And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I liked it.
I like it. My wife hates it. Absolutely hates it. So we can't really, that's not one. And The Perfect Storm's alright.
Perfect Storm was good. I like Perfect Storm. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou was not a movie I would watch over and over and over again.
No.
But I did like it.
And thank you, George Clooney, for not trying to fake a Boston accent.
Yeah, that was a good move.
That was one of the best things. He is the anti-Kevin Costner. You know what also might be on my underrated list is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Maybe not underrated, though. It made it like $200 million or $300 million worldwide, so I don't know if underrated.
Yeah, I don't know if you can really call that underrated.
So you probably can't. But I do like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. So, and What Women Want, I can't believe that's the fifth highest grossing movie of that year.
That's with Mel Gibson?
Mel Gibson, and he can read the minds of... There's like 5 minutes of good comedy in there, and the rest of it is eh. So, anyway. Anything else?
That's really all I got.
Well, Matt, this is our 100th episode.
Congratulations to you, my friend.
Congratulations to you. Congratulations to you. Century mark. This is big. It's very big. But we would like to thank all of our listeners. And, you know, Sweeney apparently has listened to well over 100 hours of us talking, which is, I'm sorry.
Actually, it sounds kind of painful when you talk about it that way.
Yeah. Well, it's probably not 100 hours. We used to be shorter, especially when we didn't have guests. And it's not 100 hours of us because we have guests. So it's more like 50 hours of us talking or 60. That sounds a little bit more bearable, but not by much. But this is 100 episodes. Never thought we would get this far. And here we are, Matt. 100 episodes in.
I wasn't even sure if we would do two.
And
so all of it's been gravy.
I'm not going to share numbers, but, man, we're getting a lot more people listening, and we really appreciate it. And one of these days, I'm going to do a highlight version of the podcast where I pull some classic clips, including I've got to find you telling Riley Nelson that he needs to hide it. Go for the sake of the team, go take off his jersey and go hide in the locker room so the coaches don't put him in. And that was years before he was as bad as he would become.
No, it turned out to be a prophetic statement, really. Yes,
it totally did.
And the funny thing is I came full circle on that one. I got onto the Riley Nelson bandwagon and jumped right back off of it with everybody else.
Yes, you did. And the other thing I've got to find, Matt, is the time, a couple of times, where we started laughing so hard on the podcast. And I don't remember. Do you remember who tweeted this? I couldn't find it on our I looked through it in our history, but Twitter stinks at finding things that when you tried to do it. But somebody said they felt like they were listening to their parents laugh at something when they were a kid, and they weren't sure what it was, but they laughed anyway.
I don't.
Who was that? Whoever it is, if you're still listening to the podcast, tweet us.
And I think it might have been Sweeney. I don't remember.
No, it wasn't Sweeney. It wasn't Sweeney.
I remember listening to it once, that podcast, because it happened a couple of times on the bus coming home, and I started laughing uncontrollably again on the bus. I was crying. I was laughing so hard listening to the podcast on my headphones on. I'm pretty sure it's, you know what they say, if you can't find the crazy person on the bus, it's probably you. That was me.
Well, you can tweet us at BYU_RiseShout. You can email us adam@loyalcougars.com and matt@loyalcougars.com. And of course you can read us and other awesome writers, including at Post Jimmer. Steve Pierce has joined our staff on Baker's the Foe covering basketball. So definitely check this out. But thanks again, everybody. 100 episodes in. Hopefully we'll be talking to you at episode 200 in a couple years. What do you think about that?
I'll be there.
Threw down the gauntlet right there. So, well, thanks everybody for listening. As always, thank you for downloading, and we will catch you for another 100 episodes or so.
Go Cougars.
Well, I hear you whispering the words to melt everyone, but you stay so.